When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 16 of The Inimitable Jeeves. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Inimitable Jeeves by P.G. Woodhouse. Chapter 16. The Delayed Exit of Claude and Eustace. The feeling I had when Aunt Agatha trapped me in my lair that morning and spilled the bad news was that my luck had broken at last. As a rule, you see, I'm not lugged into family rows. On the occasions when Aunt is calling to Aunt, like mastodons bellowing across primeval swamps, and Uncle James's letter about Cousin Mabel's peculiar behaviors being shot round the family circle, please read this carefully and send it on to Jane. The clan has a tendency to ignore me. It's one of the advantages I get from being a bachelor, and, according to my nearest and dearest, practically a half-witted bachelor at that. It's no good trying to get Bertie to take the slightest interest, is more or less the slogan, and I'm bound to say I'm all for it. A quiet life is what I like. And that's why I felt the curse had come upon me, so to speak, when Aunt Agatha sailed into my sitting room while I was having a placid cigarette and started to tell me about Claude and Eustace. "Thank goodness," said Aunt Agatha. "Arrangements have at last been made about Eustace and Claude." "Arrangements?" I said, not having the foggiest. "They sail on Friday for South Africa. Mr. Van Alstyne, a friend of poor Emily's, has given them berths in his firm at Johannesburg, and we are hoping that they will settle down there and do well." I didn't get the thing at all. "Friday? The day after tomorrow, do you mean?" "Yes." "For South Africa?" "Yes. They leave on the Edinburgh Castle." "But what's the idea? I mean, aren't they in the middle of their term at Oxford?" Aunt Agatha looked at me coldly. "Do you positively mean to tell me, Bertie, that you take so little interest in the affairs of your nearest relatives that you are not aware that Claude and Eustace were expelled from Oxford over a fortnight ago?" "No, really?" "You are hopeless, Bertie. I should have thought that even you—why were they sent down?" "They poured lemonade on the junior dean of their college. I see nothing amusing in the outrage, Bertie." "No, no, rather not," I said hurriedly. "I wasn't laughing. Choking. Got something stuck in my throat, you know." "Poor Emily," went on Aunt Agatha, "being one of those doting mothers who are the ruin of their children, wished to keep the boys in London. She suggested that they might cram for the army. But I was firm. The colonies are the only place for wild youths like Eustace and Claude. So they sail on Friday. They have been staying for the last 2 weeks with your Uncle Clive in Worcestershire. They will spend tomorrow night in London and catch the boat train on Friday morning." "Bit risky, isn't it? I mean, aren't they apt to cut loose a bit tomorrow night if they're left all alone in London?" "They will not be alone. They will be in your charge." "Mine?" "Yes. I wish you to put them up in your flat for the night and see that they do not miss the train in the morning." "Oh, I say, no, Bertie." "Well, I mean, quite jolly coves, both of them, but I don't know. They're rather nuts, you know. Always glad to see them, of course, but when it comes to putting them up for the night, Bertie, if you are so sunk in callous self-indulgence that you cannot even put yourself to this trifling inconvenience for the sake of—" "Oh, all right," I said, "all right." It was no good arguing, of course. Aunt Agatha always makes me feel as if I had gelatin where my spine ought to be. She's one of those forceful females. I should think Queen Elizabeth must have been something like her. When she holds me with a glittering eye and says, "Jump to it, my lad," or words to that effect, I make it so without further discussion. When she had gone, I rang for Jeeves to break the news to him. "Oh, Jeeves," I said, "Mr. Claude and Mr. Eustace will be staying here tomorrow night."
"Very good, sir."
"I'm glad you think so. To me, the outlook seems black and scaly. You know what those two lads are."
"Very high-spirited young gentlemen, sir."
"Blisters, Jeeves. Undeniable blisters. It's a bit thick."
"Would there be anything further, sir?"
At that, I'm bound to say, I drew myself up a trifle haughtily. We Woosters freeze like the dickens when we seek sympathy and meet with cold reserve. I knew what was up, of course. For the last day or so there had been a certain amount of coolness in the home over a pair of jazz spats which I dug up while exploring in the Burlington Arcade. Some dashed brainy cove, probably the chap who invented those colored cigarette cases, had recently had the rather topping idea of putting out a line of spats on the same system. I mean to say, instead of the ordinary gray and white, you can now get them in your regimental or school colors. And believe me, it would have taken a chappie of stronger fiber than I am to resist the pair of old Etonian spats which had smiled up at me from inside the window. I was inside the shop opening negotiations before it had even occurred to me that Jeeves might not approve. And I must say, he had taken the thing a bit hardly. The fact of the matter is, Jeeves, though in many ways the best valet in London, is too conservative. Hidebound, if you know what I mean, and an enemy to progress. "Nothing further, Jeeves," I said, with quiet dignity.
"Very good, sir."
He gave one frosty look at the spats and biffed off. "Dash him." Anything merrier and brighter than the twins, when they curveted into the old flat while I was dressing for dinner the next night, I have never struck in my whole puff. I am only about half a dozen years older than Claude and Eustace, but in some rummy manner they always make me feel as if I were well on in the grandfather class and just waiting for the end. Almost before I realized they were in the place, they had collared the best chairs, pinched a couple of my special cigarettes, poured themselves out a whiskey and soda apiece, and started to prattle with the gaiety and abandon of two birds who had achieved their life's ambition, instead of having come a most frightful purler and being under sentence of exile. "Hello, Bertie, old thing," said Claude. "Jolly decent of you to put us up." "Oh, no," I said. "Only wish you were staying a good long time." "Hear that, Eustace? He wishes we were staying a good long time." "I expect it will seem a good long time," said Eustace philosophically. "You heard about the binge, Bertie? Our little bit of trouble, I mean?" "Oh, yes. Aunt Agatha was telling me." "We leave our country for our country's good," said Eustace. "And let there be no moaning at the bar," said Claude, "when I put out to sea." "What did Aunt Agatha tell you?" "She said you poured lemonade on the junior dean." "I wish the deuce," said Claude, annoyed, "that people would get these things right. It wasn't the junior dean, it was the senior tutor." "And it wasn't lemonade," said Eustace, "it was soda water." The dear old thing happened to be standing just under our window while I was leaning out with a siphon in my hand. He looked up and, well, it would have been chucking away the opportunity of a lifetime if I hadn't let him have it in the eyeball. "Simply chucking it away," agreed Claude. "Might never have occurred again," said Eustace. 100 to 1 against it," said Claude. "Now what," said Eustace, "do you propose to do, Bertie, in the way of entertaining the handsome guests tonight?" "My idea was to have a bite of dinner in the flat," I said. "Jeeves is getting it ready now." "And afterwards?" "Well, I thought we might chat of this and that, and then it struck me that you would probably like to turn in early, as your train goes about 10 or something, doesn't it?" The twins looked at each other in a pitying sort of way. "Bertie," said Eustace, "you've got the program nearly right, but not quite. I envisage the evening's events thus.
We will toddle along to Ciro's after dinner. It's an extension night, isn't it? Well, that will see us through till about 2:30 or 3. After which, no doubt, said Claude, the Lord will provide.
But I thought you would want to get a good night's rest.
Good night's rest? Said Eustace.
My dear old chap, you don't for a moment imagine that we are dreaming of going to bed tonight, do you?
I suppose the fact of the matter is, I'm not the man I was. I mean, these all-night vigils don't seem to fascinate me as they used to a few years ago. I can remember a time, when I was up at Oxford, when a Covent Garden ball till 6 in the morning, with breakfast at the Hammonds and probably a free fight with a few selected costermongers to follow, seemed to me what the doctor ordered. But nowadays, 2 o'clock is about my limit, and by 2 o'clock the twins were just settling down and beginning to go nicely. As far as I can remember, we went on from Ciro's to play chemi with some fellows I don't recall having met before, and it must have been about 9 in the morning when we fetched up again at the flat. By which time, I'm bound to admit, as far as I was concerned, the first careless freshness was beginning to wear off a bit. In fact, I'd got just enough strength to say goodbye to the twins, wish them a pleasant voyage and a happy and successful career in South Africa, and stagger into bed. The last I remember was hearing the blighters chanting like larks under the cold shower, breaking off from time to time to shout to Jeeves to rush along the eggs and bacon. It must have been about 1 in the afternoon when I woke. I was feeling more or less like something the Pure Food Committee had rejected, but there was one bright thought which cheered me up, and that was that about now the twins would be leaning on the rail of the liner, taking the last glimpse of the dear old homeland. Which made it all the more of a shock when the door opened and Claude walked in.
"Hello, Bertie," said Claude. "Had a nice refreshing sleep? Now, what about a good old bite of lunch?"
I'd been having so many distorted nightmares since I had dropped off to sleep that for half a minute I thought this was simply one more of them, and the worst of the lot. It was only when Claude sat down on my feet that I got on to the fact that this was stern reality.
"Great Scott, what on earth are you doing here?" I gurgled.
Claude looked at me reproachfully.
"Hardly the tone I like to hear in a host, Bertie," he said reprovingly. "Why, it was only last night that you were saying you wished I was stopping a good long time. Your dream has come true. I am.
But why aren't you on your way to South Africa?"
"Now that," said Claude, "is a point I rather thought you would want to have explained. It's like this, old man. You remember that girl you introduced me to at Ciro's last night?"
"Which girl?"
"There was only one," said Claude coldly. "Only one that counted, that is to say. Her name was Marion Warder. I danced with her a good deal, if you remember."
I began to recollect in a hazy sort of way. Marion Warder has been a pal of mine for some time. A very good sort. She's playing in that show at the Apollo at the moment. I remembered now that she had been at Ciro's with a party the night before, and the twins had insisted on being introduced.
"We are soulmates, Bertie," said Claude. "I found it out quite early in the PM, and the more thought I've given to the matter, the more convinced I've become."
"It happens like that now and then, you know. Two hearts that beat as one, I mean, and all that sort of thing. So the long and the short of it is that I gave old Eustace the slip at Waterloo and slid back here. The idea of going to South Africa and leaving a girl like that in England doesn't appeal to me a bit. I'm all for thinking imperially and giving the colonies a leg up and all that sort of thing, but it can't be done. After all," said Claude reasonably, "South Africa has got along all right without me up till now, so why shouldn't it stick it?
But what about Van Alstyne, or whatever his name is? He'll be expecting you to turn up."
"Oh, he'll have Eustace. That'll satisfy him. Very sound fellow, Eustace. Probably end up by being a magnate of some kind. I shall watch his future progress with considerable interest. And now you must excuse me for a moment, Bertie. I want to go and hunt up Jeeves and get him to mix me one of those pick-me-ups of his. For some reason, which I can't explain, I've got a slight headache this morning." And believe me or believe me not, the door had hardly closed behind him when in blew Eustace with a shining morning face that made me ill to look at. "Oh, my aunt," I said.
Eustace started to giggle pretty freely.
"Smooth work, Bertie, smooth work," he said.
"I'm sorry for poor old Claude, but there was no alternative. I eluded his vigilance at Waterloo and snaked off in a taxi. I suppose the poor old ass is wondering where the deuce I've got to, but it couldn't be helped. If you really seriously expected me to go slogging off to South Africa, you shouldn't have introduced me to Miss Wardour last night."
"I want to tell you all about that, Bertie. I'm not a man," said Eustace, sitting down on the bed, "who falls in love with every girl he sees. I suppose strong silent would be the best description you could find for me. But when I do meet my affinity, I don't waste time. Oh, heaven! Are you in love with Marion Wardour, too?"
"Too? What do you mean, too?"
I was going to tell him about Claude when the blighter came in person, looking like a giant refreshed.
There's no doubt that Jeeves's pick-me-ups will produce immediate results in anything short of an Egyptian mummy. It's something he puts in them, the Worcestershire sauce or something.
Claude had revived like a watered flower, but he nearly had a relapse when he saw his bally brother goggling at him over the bed-rail.
"What on earth are you doing here?" he said. "What on earth are you doing here?" said Eustace.
"Have you come back to inflict your beastly society upon Miss Wardour? Is that why you've come back?" They thrashed the subject out a bit further.
"Well," said Claude at last, "I suppose it can't be helped. If you're here, you're here. May the best man win."
"Yes, but dash it all," I managed to put in at this point, "what's the idea? Where do you think you're going to stay if you stick on in London?"
"Why, here," said Eustace, surprised.
"Where else?" said Claude, raising his eyebrows.
"You won't object to putting us up, Bertie," said Eustace.
"Not a sportsman like you," said Claude.
"But you silly asses! Suppose Aunt Agatha finds out that I'm hiding you when you ought to be in South Africa. Where do I get off?"
"Where does he get off?" Claude asked Eustace.
"Oh, I expect he'll manage somehow," said Eustace to Claude.
"Of course," said Claude, quite cheered up. "He'll manage."
"Rather," said Eustace. "A resourceful chap like Bertie? Of course he will!"
"And now," said Claude, shelving the subject, "what about that bite of lunch we were discussing a moment ago, Bertie? That stuff good old Jeeves slipped into me just now has given me what you might call an appetite. Something in the nature of 6 chops and a batter pudding would about meet the case, I think."
"I suppose every chappie in the world has black periods in his life to which he can't look back without the smouldering eye and the silent shudder. Some coves, if you can judge by the novels you read nowadays, have them practically all the time. But what with enjoying a sizable private income and a topping digestion, I'm bound to say it isn't very often I find my own existence getting a flat tire. That's why this particular epoch is one that I don't think about more often than I can help. For the days that followed the unexpected resurrection of the blighted twins were so absolutely foul that the old nerves began to stick out of my body a foot long and curling at the ends. All of a twitter, believe me. I imagine the fact of the matter is that we Woosters are so frightfully honest and open and all that, that it gives us the pip to have to deceive." All was quiet along the Potomac for about 24 hours, and then Aunt Agatha trickled in to have a chat. 20 minutes earlier, and she would have found the twins gaily shoving themselves outside a couple of rashers and an egg. She sank into a chair, and I could see that she was not in her usual sunny spirits.
"Bertie," she said, "I am uneasy."
So was I. I didn't know how long she intended to stop, or when the twins were coming back.
"I wonder," she said, "if I took too harsh a view towards Claude and Eustace."
"You couldn't."
"What do you mean?"
I mean it would be so unlike you to be harsh to anybody, Aunt Agatha."
"And not bad, either. I mean quick, like that, without thinking." It pleased the old relative, and she looked at me with slightly less loathing than she usually does.
"It's nice of you to say that, Bertie, but what I was thinking was, are they safe?"
"Are they what?"
It seemed such a rummy adjective to apply to the twins, they being about as innocuous as a couple of sprightly young tarantulas. "Do you think all is well with them?" "How do you mean?" Aunt Agatha eyed me almost wistfully. "Has it ever occurred to you, Bertie," she said, "that your Uncle George may be psychic?" She seemed to me to be changing the subject. "Psychic? Do you think it possible that he could see things not visible to the normal eye?" I thought it dashed possible, if not probable. "I don't know if you've ever met my Uncle George. He's a festive old egg who wanders from club to club continually, having a couple with other festive old eggs. When he heaves in sight, waiters brace themselves up and the wine steward toys with his corkscrew. It was my Uncle George who discovered that alcohol was a food well in advance of modern medical thought. Your Uncle George was dining with me last night, and he was quite shaken. He declares that, while on his way from the Devonshire Club to Boodle's, he suddenly saw the phantasm of Eustace." "The what of Eustace?" "The phantasm. The wraith. It was so clear that he thought for an instant that it was Eustace himself. The figure vanished round a corner, and when Uncle George got there, nothing was to be seen. It was all very queer and disturbing. It had a marked effect on poor George. All through dinner he touched nothing but barley water, and his manner was quite disturbed. You do think those poor dear boys are safe, Bertie? They have not met with some horrible accident?" It made my mouth water to think of it, but I said no, I didn't think they had met with any horrible accident. I thought Eustace was a horrible accident, and clawed about the same, but I didn't say so. And presently she biffed off, still worried. When the twins came in, I put it squarely to the blighters. Jolly as it was to give Uncle George shocks, they must not wander at large about the metrop. "But, my dear old soul," said Claude, "be reasonable. We can't have our movements hampered." "Out of the question," said Eustace. "The whole essence of the thing, if you understand me," said Claude, "is that we should be at liberty to flit hither and thither." "Exactly," said Eustace. "Now hither, now thither." "But damn it, Bertie," said Eustace reprovingly, "not before the boy." "Of course, in a way, I see his point," said Claude. "I suppose the solution of the problem would be to buy a couple of disguises." "My dear old chap," said Eustace, looking at him with admiration. "The brightest idea on record! Not your own, surely?" "Well, as a matter of fact, it was Bertie who put it into my head." "Me?" "You were telling me the other day about old Bingo Little and the beard he bought when he didn't want his uncle to recognize him." "If you think I'm going to have you two excrescences popping in and out of my flat in beards—" "Something in that," agreed Eustace. "We'll make it whiskers, then." "And false noses," said Claude. "And, as you say, false noses. Righto then, Bertie, old chap, that's a load off your mind. We don't want to be any trouble to you while we're paying you this little visit." And when I went buzzing round to Jeeves for consolation, all he would say was something about young blood. No sympathy. "Very good, Jeeves," I said. "I shall go for a walk in the park. Kindly put me out the old Etonian spats." "Very good, sir." It must have been a couple of days after that that Marion Wardour rolled in at about the hour of tea. She looked warily round the room before sitting down. "Your cousin's not at home, Bertie?" she said.
"No, thank goodness."
"Then I'll tell you where they are. They're in my sitting room, glaring at each other from opposite corners, waiting for me to come in. Bertie, this has got to stop." "You're seeing a good deal of them, are you?" "Jeeves came in with the tea, but the poor girl was so worked up that she didn't wait for him to pop off before going on with her complaint. She had an absolutely hunted air, poor thing. I can't move a step without tripping over one or both of them," she said. "Generally both. They've taken to calling together, and they just settle down grimly and try to sit each other out. It's wearing me to a shadow."
"I know," I said sympathetically, "I know."
"Well, what's to be done?"
"It beats me. Couldn't you tell your maid to say you are not at home?"
She shuddered slightly. "I tried that once. They camped on the stairs, and I couldn't get out all the afternoon. And I had a lot of particularly important engagements. I wish you would persuade them to go to South Africa, where they seem to be wanted.
You must have made the dickens of an impression on them."
"I should say I have. They've started giving me presents now. At least Claude has. He insisted on my accepting this cigarette case last night. Came round to the theater and wouldn't go away till I took it. It's not a bad one, I must say."
It wasn't.
It was a distinctly fruity concern in gold with a diamond stuck in the middle. And the rummy thing was that I had a notion I'd seen something very like it before somewhere. How the deuce Claude had been able to dig up the cash to buy a thing like that was more than I could imagine.
Next day was a Wednesday, and as the object of their devotion had a matinee, the twins were, so to speak, off duty. Claude had gone with his whiskers on to Hurst Park, and Eustace and I were in the flat talking. At least he was talking, and I was wishing he would go. "The love of a good woman, Bertie," he was saying, "must be a wonderful thing. Sometimes—good Lord, what's that?" The front door had opened, and from out in the hall there came the sound of Aunt Agatha's voice asking if I was in. Aunt Agatha has one of those high, penetrating voices, but this was the first time I'd ever been thankful for it. There was just about 2 seconds to clear the way for her, but it was long enough for Eustace to dive under the sofa. His last shoe had just disappeared when she came in. She had a worried look. It seemed to me about this time that everybody had. "Bertie," she said, "what are your immediate plans?"
"How do you mean?
I'm dining tonight with—"
"Oh, no, no, I don't mean tonight. Are you busy for the next few days?
But of course you are not," she went on, not waiting for me to answer. "You never have anything to do. Your whole life is spent in idle. But we can go into that later. What I came for this afternoon was to tell you that I wish you to go with your poor Uncle George to Harrogate for a few weeks. The sooner you can start, the better."
This appeared to me to approximate so closely to the frozen limit that I uttered a yelp of protest.
"Uncle George is all right, but he won't do." I was trying to say as much when she waved me down.
"If you are not entirely heartless, Bertie, you will do as I ask you. Your poor Uncle George has had a severe shock."
"What, another?"
"He feels that only complete rest and careful medical attendance can restore his nervous system to its normal poise. It seems that in the past he has derived benefit from taking the waters at Harrogate, and he wishes to go there now. We do not think he ought to be alone, so I wish you to accompany him."
"But I say, Bertie—"
There was a lull in the conversation.
"What shock has he had?" I asked.
"Between ourselves," said Aunt Agatha, lowering her voice in an impressive manner, "I incline to think that the whole affair was the outcome of an overexcited imagination. You are one of the family, Bertie, and I can speak freely to you. You know as well as I do that your poor Uncle George has for many years not been a—he has, developed a habit of—how shall I put it—shifting it a bit? I beg your pardon? Mopping up the stuff to some extent? I dislike your way of putting it exceedingly, but I must confess that he has not been, perhaps, as temperate as he should. He is highly strung, and—well, the fact is, he has had a shock."
"Yes, but what?"
"That is what is so hard to induce him to explain with any precision. With all his good points, your Uncle George is apt to become incoherent when strongly moved. As far as I could gather, he appears to have been the victim of a burglary."
"Burglary?"
"He says that a strange man with whiskers and a peculiar nose entered his rooms at Jermyn Street during his absence and stole some of his property. He says that he came back and found the man in his sitting room. He immediately rushed out of the room and disappeared."
"Uncle George?"
"No, the man. And according to your Uncle George,
he had stolen a valuable cigarette case. But, as I say, I am inclined to think that the whole thing was imagination. He has not been himself since the day that he fancied that he saw Eustace in the street. So I should like you, Bertie, to be prepared to start for Harrogate with him not later than Saturday." She popped off, and Eustace crawled out from under the sofa. The blighter was strongly moved. So was I, for the matter of that. The idea of several weeks with Uncle George at Harrogate seemed to make everything go black. "So that's where he got that cigarette case, dash him," said Eustace bitterly. "Of all the dirty tricks, robbing his own flesh and blood, the fellow ought to be in Chokey." "He ought to be in South Africa," I said, "and so ought you." And with an eloquence which rather surprised me, I hauled up my slacks for perhaps 10 minutes on the subject of his duty to his family and what not. I appealed to his sense of decency. I boosted South Africa with vim. I said everything I could think of, much of it twice over. But all the blighter did was to babble about his dashed brother's baseness in putting one over on him in the matter of the cigarette case. He seemed to think that Claude, by slinging in the handsome gift, had got right ahead of him, and there was a painful scene when the latter came back from Hurst Park. I could hear them talking half the night, long after I had tottered off to bed. I don't know when I've met fellows who could do with less sleep than those two. After this, things became a bit strained on the flat owing to Claude and Eustace not being on speaking terms. I'm all for a certain chumminess in the home, and it was wearing to have to live with two fellows who wouldn't admit that the other one was on the map at all. One felt the thing couldn't go on like that for long, and by Jove, it didn't. But if anyone had come to me the day before and told me what was going to happen, I should simply have smiled wanly. I mean, I'd got so accustomed to thinking that nothing short of a dynamite explosion could ever dislodge those two nestlers from my midst, that when Claude sidled up to me on the Friday morning and told me his bit of news, I could hardly believe I was hearing right. "Bertie," he said, "I've been thinking it over." "What over?" I said. "The whole thing. This business of staying in London when I ought to be in South Africa." "It isn't fair," said Claude warmly. "It isn't right. And the long and short of it is, Bertie, old man, I'm leaving tomorrow." I reeled in my tracks. "You are?" I gasped. "Yes, if," said Claude, "you won't mind sending old Jeeves out to buy a ticket for me. I'm afraid I'll have to stick you for the passage money, old man. You don't mind?" "Mind?" I said, clutching his hand fervently. "That's all right, then. Oh, I say, you won't say a word to Eustace about this, will you?" "But isn't he going too?" Claude shuddered. "No, thank heaven. The idea of being cooped up on board a ship with that blighter gives me the pip just to think of it. No, not a word to Eustace. I say, I suppose you can get me a berth all right at such short notice?" "Rather," I said. "Sooner than let this opportunity slip, I would have bought the bally boat." "Jeeves," I said, breezing into the kitchen, "go out on first speed to the Union Castle offices and book a berth on tomorrow's boat for Mr. Claude. He is leaving us, Jeeves."
"Yes, sir."
"Mr. Claude does not wish any mention of this to be made to Mr. Eustace."
"No, sir.
Mr. Eustace made the same proviso when he desired me to obtain a berth on tomorrow's boat for himself." I gaped at the man. "Is he going too?"
"Yes, sir."
"This is rummy."
"Yes, sir."
Had circumstances been other than they were, I would at this juncture have unbent considerably towards Jeeves. Frisked round him a bit and whooped to a certain extent and what not. But those spats still formed a barrier, and I regret to say that I took the opportunity of rather rubbing it in a bit on the man. I mean, he'd been so dashed aloof and unsympathetic, though perfectly aware that the young master was in the soup and that it was up to him to rally round, that I couldn't help pointing out how the happy ending had been snaffled without any help from him. "So that's that, Jeeves," I said. "The episode is concluded. I knew things would sort themselves out if one gave them time and didn't get rattled. Many chaps in my place would have got rattled, Jeeves.
Yes, sir.
Gone rushing about, I mean, asking people for help and advice and so forth.
Very possibly, sir.
But not me, Jeeves.
No, sir.
I left him to brood on it. Even the thought that I'd got to go to Harrogate with Uncle George couldn't depress me that Saturday when I gazed about the old flat and realized that Claude and Eustace weren't in it. They had slunk off stealthily and separately immediately after breakfast, Eustace to catch the boat train to Waterloo, Claude to go round to the garage where I kept my car. I didn't want any chance of the two meeting at Waterloo and changing their minds, so I had suggested to Claude that he might find it pleasanter to drive down to Southampton. I was lying back on the old settee, gazing peacefully up at the flies on the ceiling and feeling what a wonderful world this was, when Jeeves came in with a letter.
"A messenger boy has brought this, sir."
I opened the envelope, and the first thing that fell out was a 5-pound note.
"Great Scott," I said, "what's all this?"
The letter was scribbled in pencil and was quite brief. "Dear Bertie, will you give enclosed to your man and tell him I wish I could make it more? He has saved my life. This is the first happy day I've had for a week. Yours, M.W. Jeeves was standing holding out the fiver, which had fluttered to the floor.
"You'd better stick to it," I said. "It seems to be for you."
"Sir?"
"I say that fiver is for you, apparently. Miss Warder sent it."
"That was extremely kind of her, sir."
"What the dickens is she sending you fivers for? She says you saved her life."
Jeeves smiled gently.
"She overestimates my services, sir."
"But what were your services, dash it?"
"It was in the matter of Mr. Claude and Mr. Eustace, sir. I was hoping that she would not refer to the matter, as I did not wish you to think that I had been taking a liberty."
"What do you mean?"
"I chanced to be in the room while Miss Warder was complaining with some warmth of the manner in which Mr. Claude and Mr. Eustace were thrusting their society upon her. I felt that in the circumstances it might be excusable if I suggested a slight ruse to enable her to dispense with their attentions."
"Good Lord! You don't mean to say you were at the bottom of their popping off after all?"
"Silly ass, it made me feel. I mean, after rubbing it into him like that about having clicked without his assistance."
"It occurred to me that, were Miss Warder to inform Mr. Claude and Mr. Eustace independently that she proposed sailing for South Africa to take up a theatrical engagement, the desired effect might be produced. It appears that my anticipations were correct, sir. The young gentleman ate it, if I may use the expression."
"Jeeves," I said, "we Woosters may make bloomers, but we are never too proud to admit it. You stand alone."
"Thank you very much, sir."
"Oh, but I say—" A ghastly thought had struck me. "When they get on the boat and find she isn't there, won't they come buzzing back?"
"I anticipated that possibility, sir. At my suggestion, Miss Warder informed the young gentleman that she proposed to travel overland to Madeira and join the vessel there."
"And where do they touch after Madeira?"
"Nowhere, sir."
For a moment I just lay back, letting the idea of the thing soak in. There seemed to me to be only one flaw.
"The only pity is," I said, "that on a large boat like that they will be able to avoid each other. I mean, I should have liked to feel that Claude was having a good deal of Eustace's society and vice versa."
"I fancy that will be so, sir. I secured a 2-berth stateroom. Mr. Claude will occupy one berth, Mr. Eustace the other."
I sighed with pure ecstasy. It seemed a dashed shame that on this joyful occasion I should have to go off to Harrogate with my Uncle George.
"Have you started packing yet, Jeeves?" I asked.
"Packing, sir?"
"For Harrogate. I've got to go there today with Sir George."
"Of course, yes, sir. I forgot to mention it. Sir George rang up on the telephone this morning while you were still asleep and said that he had changed his plans. He does not intend to go to Harrogate."
Oh, I say, how absolutely topping!
I thought you might be pleased, sir.
What made him change his plans? Did he say?
No, sir, but I gather from his man Stevens that he's feeling much better and does not now require a rest cure. I took the liberty of giving Stevens the recipe for that pick-me-up of mine, of which you have always approved so much. Stevens tells me that Sir George informed him this morning that he is feeling a new man. Well, there was only one thing to do, and I did it. I'm not saying it didn't hurt, but there was no alternative.
"Jeeves," I said, "those spats."
"Yes, sir."
"You really dislike them?"
"Intensely, sir."
"You don't think time might induce you to change your views?"
"No, sir."
"All right, then. Very well. Say no more. You may burn them."
"Thank you very much, sir. I have already done so. Before breakfast this morning. A quiet gray is far more suitable, sir."
"Thank you, sir."
End of chapter 16. Chapter 17 of The Inimitable Jeeves. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Inimitable Jeeves by P.G. Woodhouse. Chapter 17. Bingo and the Little Woman. It must have been a week or so after the departure of Claude and Eustace that I ran into young Bingo Little in the smoking room of the Senior Liberal Club. He was lying back in an armchair with his mouth open and a sort of goofy expression in his eyes, while a gray-bearded cove in the middle distance watched him with so much dislike that I concluded that Bingo had pinched his favorite seat. That's the worst of being in a strange club. Absolutely without intending it, you find yourself constantly trampling upon the vested interests of the oldest inhabitants. "Hello, Face," I said.
"Cheerio, ugly,"
said young Bingo, and we settled down to have a small one before lunch. Once a year, the Committee of the Drones decides that the old club could do with a wash and brush-up, so they shoo us out and dump us down for a few weeks at some other institution. This time we were roosting at the Senior Liberal, and personally I had found the strain pretty fearful. I mean, when you've got used to a club where everything's nice and cheery, and where, if you want to attract a chappie's attention, you heave a bit of bread at him, it kind of damps you to come to a place where the youngest member is about 87, and it isn't considered good form to talk to anyone unless you and he were through the Peninsular War together. It was a relief to come across Bingo. We started to talk in hushed voices.
"This club, I say, is the limit."
"It is the eel's eyebrows," agreed young Bingo.
"I believe that old boy over by the window has been dead 3 days, but I don't like to mention it to anyone."
"Have you lunched here yet?"
"No, why?"
"They have waitresses instead of waiters."
"Good Lord! I thought that went out with the armistice."
Bingo mused a moment, straightening his tie absently.
"Pretty girls?" he said.
"No."
He seemed disappointed, but pulled round.
"Well, I've heard that the cooking's the best in London."
"So they say. Shall we be going in?"
"All right."
"I expect," said young Bingo, "that at the end of the meal, or possibly at the beginning, the waitress will say, 'Both together, sir?'"
"Reply in the affirmative. I haven't a bean."
"Hasn't your uncle forgiven you yet?"
"Not yet, confound him."
I was sorry to hear the row was still on. I resolved to do the poor old thing well at the festive board, and I scanned the menu with some intentness when the girl rolled up with it.
"How would this do you, Bingo?" I said at length. "A few plover's eggs to weigh in with, a cup of soup, a touch of cold salmon, some cold curry, and a splash of gooseberry tart and cream with a bite of cheese to finish."
I don't know that I expected the man actually to scream with delight, though I had picked the items from my knowledge of his pet dishes, but I had expected him to say something. I looked up and found that his attention was elsewhere. He was gazing at the waitress with the look of a dog that's just remembered where its bone was buried. She was a tallish girl with sort of soft, soulful brown eyes. Nice figure and all that. Rather decent hands, too. I didn't remember having seen her about before, and I must say she raised the standard of the place quite a bit. "How about it, laddie?" I said, being all for getting the order booked and going on to the serious knife and fork work. "Eh?" said young Bingo absently. I recited the program once more. "Oh, yes, fine," said Bingo. "Anything, anything." The girl pushed off, and he turned to me with protruding eyes. "I thought you said they weren't pretty, Bertie," he said reproachfully. "Oh, my heavens," I said, "you surely haven't fallen in love again, and with a girl you've only just seen?" "There are times, Bertie," said young Bingo, "when a look is enough, when passing through a crowd, we meet somebody's eye and something seems to whisper." At this point, the plover's eggs arrived, and he suspended his remarks in order to swoop on them with some vigor. "Jeeves," I said that night when I got home, "stand by."
"Sir?"
"Burnish the old brain and be alert and vigilant. I suspect that Mr. Little will be calling round shortly for sympathy and assistance."
"Is Mr. Little in trouble, sir?"
"Well, you might call it that. He's in love. For about the 53rd time. I ask you, Jeeves, as man to man, did you ever see such a chap?"
"Mr. Little is certainly warm-hearted, sir."
"Warm-hearted? I should think he has to wear asbestos vests. Well, stand by, Jeeves."
"Very good, sir."
And sure enough, it wasn't 10 days before in rolled the old ass, bleeding for volunteers to step one pace forward and come to the aid of the party. "Bertie," he said, "if you are a pal of mine, now is the time to show it."
"Proceed, old gargoyle," I replied. "You have our ear."
"You remember giving me lunch at the Senior Liberal some days ago? We were waited on by a, I remember, tall, lissom female."
He shuddered somewhat.
"I wish you wouldn't talk of her like that, dash it all. She's an angel."
"All right, carry on."
"I love her."
"Righto, push along."
"For goodness sake, don't bustle me. Let me tell the story in my own way. I love her, as I was saying, and I want you, Bertie, old boy, to pop round to my uncle and do a bit of diplomatic work. That allowance of mine must be restored, and dashed quick, too. What's more, it must be increased." "But look here," I said, being far from keen on the bally business, "why not wait a while?"
"Wait? What's the good of waiting?"
"Well, you know what generally happens when you fall in love. Something goes wrong with the works and you get left. Much better tackle your uncle after the whole thing's fixed and settled."
"It is fixed and settled. She accepted me this morning."
"Good Lord, that's quick work. You haven't known her 2 weeks."
"Not in this life, no," said young Bingo.
"But she has a sort of idea that we must have met in some previous existence. She thinks I must have been a king in Babylon when she was a Christian slave. I can't say I remember it myself, but there may be something in it."
"Great Scott," I said, "do waitresses really talk like that?"
"How should I know how waitresses talk?" "Well, you ought to know by now. The first time I ever met your uncle was when you hounded me on to ask him if he would rally round to help you marry that girl Mabel in the Piccadilly Bun Shop."
Bingo started violently. A wild gleam came into his eyes.
And before I knew what he was up to, he had brought down his hand with a most frightful whack on my summer trousering, causing me to leap like a young ram.
"Here," I said.
"Sorry," said Bingo, "excited, carried away. You've given me an idea, Bertie." He waited till I had finished massaging the limb and resumed his remarks. "Can you throw your mind back to that occasion, Bertie? Do you remember the frightfully subtle scheme I worked? Telling him you were, what's her name, the woman who wrote those books, I mean?" It wasn't likely I'd forget. The ghastly thing was absolutely seared into my memory.
"That is the line of attack," said Bingo. "That is the scheme. Rosie M. Banks forward once more."
"It can't be done, old thing. Sorry, but it's out of the question. I couldn't go through all that again.
Not for me. Not for a dozen more like you.
I never thought, said Bingo sorrowfully, to hear those words from Bertie Wooster.
Well, you've heard them now, I said. Paste them in your hat.
Bertie, we were at school together.
It wasn't my fault.
We've been pals for 15 years.
I know. It's going to take the rest of my life to live it down.
Bertie, old man, said Bingo, drawing up his chair closer and starting to knead my shoulder blade, listen, be reasonable. And of course, dash it, at the end of 10 minutes I'd allowed the blighter to talk me round. It's always the way. Anyone can talk me round. If I were in a Trappist monastery, the first thing that would happen would be that some smooth performer would lure me into some frightful idiocy against my better judgment by means of the deaf and dumb language.
"Well, what do you want me to do?" I said, realizing that it was hopeless to struggle.
"Start off by sending the old boy an autographed copy of your latest effort with a flattering inscription. That will tickle him to death. Then you pop round and put it across."
What is my latest?
The Woman Who Braved All, said young Bingo. I've seen it all over the place. The shop windows and bookstalls are full of nothing but it.
It looks to me, from the picture on the jacket, the sort of book any chappie would be proud to have written. Of course, he will want to discuss it with you.
Ah, I said, cheering up, that dishes the scheme, doesn't it? I don't know what the bally thing is about.
You will have to read it, naturally.
Read it? No, I say.
Bertie, we were at school together.
Oh, right-o, right-o, I said.
I knew I could rely on you. You have a heart of gold.
Jeeves, said young Bingo, as the faithful servitor rolled in, Mr. Wooster has a heart of gold.
Very good, sir, said Jeeves.
Bar a weekly wrestle with the pink'un and an occasional dip in the form book, I'm not much of a lad for reading, and my sufferings as I tackled The Woman, curse her, who braved all, were pretty fearful. But I managed to get through it, and only just in time, as it happened, for I'd hardly reached the bit where the lips met in one long slow kiss, and everything was still but for the gentle sighing of the breeze in the laburnum, when a messenger boy brought a note from old Biddlesham asking me to trickle round to lunch. I found the old boy in a mood you could only describe as melting. He had a copy of the book on the table beside him, and he kept turning the pages in the intervals of dealing with things in aspic and what not.
"Mr. Wooster," he said, swallowing a chunk of trout, "I wish to congratulate you. I wish to thank you. You go from strength to strength. I have read All for Love. I have read Only a Factory Girl. I know Madcap Myrtle by heart. But this is your bravest and best. It tears the heartstrings."
"Yes?"
"Indeed, yes. I have read it 3 times since you most kindly sent me the volume. I wish to thank you once more for the charming inscription, and I think I may say that I am a better, sweeter, deeper man. I am full of human charity and kindness towards my species."
"No, really?"
"Indeed, indeed I am."
"Towards the whole species?"
"Towards the whole species."
"Even young Bingo?" I said, trying him pretty high.
"My nephew, Richard?"
He looked a bit thoughtful, but stuck it like a man and refused to hedge.
"Yes, even towards Richard. Well, that is to say, perhaps. Yes, even towards Richard."
"That's good, because I wanted to talk about him. He's pretty hard up, you know."
"In straitened circumstances?"
"Stony." "And he could use a bit of the right stuff paid every quarter, if you felt like unbelting." He mused a while, and got through a slab of cold guinea hen before replying. He toyed with the book, and it fell open at page 215. I couldn't remember what was on page 215, but it must have been something tolerably zippy, for his expression changed, and he gazed up at me with misty eyes, as if he had taken a shade too much mustard with his last bite of ham.
"Very well, Mr. Wooster," he said, "fresh from a perusal of this noble work of yours, I cannot harden my heart. Richard shall have his allowance."
"Stout fellow," I said.
Then it occurred to me that the expression might strike a chappie who weighed 17 stone as a bit personal. Good egg, I mean. That'll take a weight off his mind. He wants to get married, you know.
I did not know, and I am not sure that I altogether approve. Who is the lady?
Well, as a matter of fact, she's a waitress.
He leapt in his seat. You don't say so, Mr. Wooster. This is remarkable. This is most cheering. I had not given the boy credit for such tenacity of purpose. An excellent trait in him which I had not hitherto suspected. I recollect clearly that on the occasion when I first had the pleasure of making your acquaintance, nearly 18 months ago, Richard was desirous of marrying this same waitress.
I had to break it to him.
Well, not absolutely this same waitress. In fact, quite a different waitress. Still, a waitress, you know.
The light of avuncular affection died out of the old boy's eyes.
"Hmm," he said a bit dubiously. "I had supposed that Richard was displaying the quality of constancy which is so rare in the modern young man. I must think it over."
So we left it at that, and I came away and told Bingo the position of affairs. "Allowance okay," I said. "Uncle Blessing, a trifle wobbly."
"Doesn't he seem to want the wedding bells to ring out?"
I left him thinking it over. If I were a bookie, I should feel justified in offering 108 against.
"You can't have approached him properly. I might have known you would muck it up," said young Bingo,
which, considering what I had been through for his sake, struck me as a good bit sharper than a serpent's tooth.
"It's awkward," said young Bingo. "It's infernally awkward. I can't tell you all the details at the moment, but, yes, it's awkward."
He helped himself absently to a handful of my cigars and pushed off. I didn't see him again for 3 days. Early in the afternoon on the third day, he blew in with a flower in his buttonhole and a look on his face as if someone had hit him behind the ear with a stuffed eel skin.
"Hello, Bertie."
"Hello, old turnip. Where have you been all this while?"
"Oh, here and there. Ripping weather we're having, Bertie."
"Not bad."
"I see the bank rate is down again."
"No, really?"
"Disturbing news from Lower Silesia, what?"
"Oh, dashed."
He pottered about the room for a bit, babbling at intervals. The boy seemed cuckoo.
"Oh, I say, Bertie," he said suddenly, dropping a vase which he had picked off the mantelpiece and was fiddling with, "I know what it was I wanted to tell you. I'm married."
End of chapter 17.
Chapter 18 of The Inimitable Jeeves. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Inimitable Jeeves by P. G. Woodhouse. Chapter 18. All's Well.
I stared at him. That flower in his buttonhole, that dazed look. Yes, he had all the symptoms, and yet the thing seemed incredible. The fact is, I suppose, I'd seen so many of young Bingo's love affairs start off with a whoop and a rattle and poof themselves out halfway down the straight that I couldn't believe he had actually brought it off at last.
Married.
Yes, this morning at a registrar's in Holborn. I've just come from the wedding breakfast.
I sat up in my chair, alert, the man of affairs. It seemed to me that this thing wanted threshing out in all its aspects.
"Let's get this straight," I said. "You're really married?"
"Yes."
"The same girl you were in love with the day before yesterday?"
"What do you mean?"
"Well, you know what you're like. Tell me what made you commit this rash act."
"I wish the deuce you wouldn't talk like that. I married her because I love her, dash it. The best little woman," said young Bingo, "in the world."
"That's all right, and deuced creditable, I'm sure. But have you reflected what your uncle's going to say? The last I saw of him, he was by no means in a confetti-scattering mood."
"Bertie," said Bingo, "I'll be frank with you. The little woman rather put it up to me, if you know what I mean. I told her how my uncle felt about it, and she said that we must part unless I loved her enough to brave the old boy's wrath and marry her right away. So I had no alternative.
I bought a buttonhole and went to it.
And what do you propose to do now?
Oh, I've got it all planned out. After you've seen my uncle and broken the news.
What?
After you don't mean to say you think you're going to lug me into it.
He looked at me like Lillian Gish coming out of a swoon.
Is this Bertie Wooster talking? He said, pained.
Yes, it jolly well is.
Bertie, old man, said Bingo, patting me gently here and there. Reflect. We were at school.
Oh, all right.
Good man. I knew I could rely on you. She's waiting down below in the hall. We'll pick her up and dash round to Pounceby Gardens right away.
I had only seen the bride before in her waitress kit, and I was rather expecting that on her wedding day she would have launched out into something fairly zippy in the way of upholstery. The first gleam of hope I had felt since the start of this black business came to me when I saw that, instead of being all velvet and scent and flowery hat, she was dressed in dashed good taste. Quiet. Nothing loud. So far as looks went, she might have stepped straight out of Berkeley Square.
"This is my old pal Bertie Wooster, darling," said Bingo. "We were at school together, weren't we, Bertie?"
"We were," I said. "How do you do? I think we, met at lunch the other day, didn't we?"
"Oh, yes. How do you do?"
"My uncle eats out of Bertie's hand," explained Bingo. "So he's coming round with us to start things off and kind of pave the way.
Hi, taxi!"
We didn't talk much on the journey. Kind of tense feeling. I was glad when the cab stopped at old Biddlesham's wigwam and we all hopped out. I left Bingo and wife in the hall while I went upstairs to the drawing-room, and the butler toddled off to dig out the big chief. While I was prowling about the room waiting for him to show up, I suddenly caught sight of that bally Woman Who Braved All lying on one of the tables. It was open at page 215, and a passage heavily marked in pencil caught my eye. And directly I read it, I saw that it was all to the mustard and was going to help me in my business. This was the passage.
"What can prevail?"
Millicent's eyes flashed as she faced the stern old man. "What can prevail against a pure and all-consuming love? Neither principalities nor powers, my lord, nor all the puny prohibitions of guardians and parents. I love your son, Lord Windermere, and nothing can keep us apart. Since time first began, this love of ours was fated, and who are you to pit yourself against the decrees of fate?" The Earl looked at her keenly from beneath his bushy eyebrows.
"Humph," he said.
Before I had time to refresh my memory as to what Millicent's comeback had been to that remark, the door opened and old Biddlesham rolled in, all over me as usual.
"My dear Wooster, this is an unexpected pleasure. Pray, take a seat. What can I do for you?"
"Well, the fact is, I'm more or less in the capacity of a jolly old ambassador at the moment, representing young Bingo, you know." His geniality sagged a trifle, I thought, but he didn't heave me out, so I pushed on. "The way I always look at it," I said, "is that it's dashed difficult for anything to prevail against what you might call a pure and all-consuming love. I mean, can it be done? I doubt it." My eyes didn't exactly flash as I faced the stern old man, but I sort of waggled my eyebrows. He puffed a bit and looked doubtful.
"We discussed this matter at our last meeting, Mr. Wooster, and on that occasion—"
"Yes, but there have been developments, as it were, since then. The fact of the matter is," I said, coming to the point, "this morning young Bingo went and jumped off the dock."
"Good heavens!"
He jerked himself to his feet with his mouth open.
"Why? Where? Which dock?"
I saw that he wasn't quite on. "I was speaking metaphorically," I explained. "If that's the word I want. I mean, he got married."
"Married?"
"Absolutely hitched up. I hope you aren't ratty about it, what? Young blood, you know, two loving hearts and all that." He panted in a rather overwrought way.
"I am greatly disturbed by your news. I consider that I have been, defied. Yes, defied."
"But who are you to pit yourself against the decrees of fate?" I said, taking a look at the prompt book out of the corner of my eye.
"Eh?"
You see, this love of theirs was fated, since time began, you know.
I'm bound to admit that if he'd said humph at this juncture, he would have had me stymied. Luckily, it didn't occur to him. There was a silence, during which he appeared to brood a bit. Then his eye fell on the book, and he gave a sort of start.
"Why, bless my soul, Mr. Wooster, you have been quoting."
"More or less."
"I thought your words sounded familiar."
His whole appearance changed, and he gave a sort of gurgling chuckle.
"Dear me, dear me, you know my weak spot."
He picked up the book and buried himself in it for quite a while. I began to think he had forgotten I was there. After a bit, however, he put it down again and wiped his eyes.
"Ah, well," he said.
I shuffled my feet and hoped for the best.
"Ah, well," he said again. "I must not be like Lord Windermere, must I, Mr. Wooster? Tell me, did you draw that haughty old man from a living model?"
"Oh, no. Just thought of him and bunged him down, you know."
"Genius," murmured old Bittlesham. "Genius. Well, Mr. Wooster, you have won me over. Who, as you say, am I to pit myself against the decrees of fate? I will write to Richard tonight and inform him of my consent to his marriage."
"You can slip him the glad news in person," I said. "He's waiting downstairs, with wife complete. I'll pop down and send them up. Cheerio, and thanks very much. Bingo will be most awfully bucked." I shot out and went downstairs. Bingo and Mrs. were sitting on a couple of chairs like patients in a dentist's waiting room. "Well," said Bingo eagerly. "All over except the hand-clasping," I replied, slapping the old crumpet on the back. "Charge up and get matey. Toodaloo, old things. You know where to find me if wanted. 1,000 congratulations and all that sort of rot." And I pipped, not wishing to be fawned upon. You never can tell in this world. If ever I felt that something attempted, something done, had earned a night's repose, it was when I got back to the flat and shoved my feet up on the mantelpiece and started to absorb the cup of tea which Jeeves had brought in. Used as I am to seeing life's sitters blow up in the home stretch and finish nowhere, I couldn't see any cause for alarm in this affair of young Bingo's. All he had to do when I left him at Pounceby Gardens was to walk upstairs with the little missus and collect the blessing. I was so convinced of this that when, about a half-hour later, he came galloping into my sitting-room, all I thought was that he wanted to thank me in broken accents and tell me what a good chap I had been. I merely beamed benevolently at the old creature as he entered, and was just going to offer him a cigarette when I observed that he seemed to have something on his mind. In fact, he looked as if something solid had hit him in the solar plexus. "My dear old soul," I said, "what's up?" Bingo plunged about the room. "I will be calm," he said, knocking over an occasional table. "Calm, damn it!" He upset a chair.
"Surely nothing has gone wrong."
Bingo uttered one of those hollow, mirthless yelps. "Only every bally thing that could go wrong. What do you think happened after you left us? You know that beastly book you insisted on sending my uncle?" It wasn't the way I should have put it myself, but I saw the poor old bean was upset for some reason or other, so I didn't correct him. "The woman who braved all," I said. "It came in dashed useful. It was by quoting bits out of it that I managed to talk him round." "Well, it didn't come in useful when he got into the room. It was lying on the table, and after we had started to chat a bit and everything was going along nicely, the little woman spotted it. 'Oh, have you read this, Lord Bittlesham?' she said. 'Three times already,' said my uncle. 'I'm so glad,' said the little woman. 'Why, are you also an admirer of Rosie M. Banks?' asked the old boy, beaming. 'I am Rosie M. Banks,' said the little woman.
'Oh, my aunt, not really.'
'Yes.'
'But how could she be? I mean, dash it, she was slinging the foodstuffs at the Senior Liberal Club.'
Bingo gave the settee a moody kick. "'She took the job to collect material for a book she's writing called Mervyn Keane Clubman.'
"'She might have told you.'
"'It made such a hit with her when she found that I loved her for herself alone, despite her humble station, that she kept it under her hat. She meant to spring it on me later on,' she said.
Well, what happened then? There was the dickens of a painful scene. The old boy nearly got apoplexy. Called her an impostor. They both started talking at once at the top of their voices, and the thing ended with the little woman buzzing off to her publishers to collect proofs as a preliminary to getting a written apology from the old boy. What's going to happen now, I don't know. Apart from the fact that my uncle will be as mad as a wet hen when he finds out that he has been fooled, there's going to be a lot of trouble when the little woman discovers that we worked the Rosie M. Banks wheeze with a view to trying to get me married to somebody else. You see, one of the things that first attracted her to me was the fact that I had never been in love before.
Did you tell her that?
Yes.
Great Scott!
Well, I hadn't been, not really in love. There's all the difference in the world between... Well, never mind that. What am I going to do? That's the point.
I don't know.
Thanks, said young Bingo. That's a lot of help. Next morning, he rang me up on the phone just after I got the bacon and eggs into my system. The one moment of the day, in short, when a chappie wishes to muse on life absolutely undisturbed.
Bertie.
Hello. Things are hotting up.
What's happened now?
My uncle has given the little woman's proofs the once-over and admits her claim. I've just been having 5 snappy minutes with him on the telephone. He says that you and I made a fool of him, and he could hardly speak, he was so shirty. Still, he made it clear, all right, that my allowance has gone foot again.
I'm sorry.
Don't waste time being sorry for me, said young Bingo grimly. He's coming to call on you today to demand a personal explanation.
Great Scott!
And the little woman is coming to call on you to demand a personal explanation.
Good Lord!
I shall watch your future career with some considerable interest, said young Bingo. I bellowed for Jeeves.
Jeeves!
Sir, I'm in the soup.
Indeed, sir. I sketched out the scenario for him.
What would you advise?
I think if I were you, sir, I would accept Mr. Pitt Whaley's invitation immediately. If you remember, sir, he invited you to shoot with him in Norfolk this week.
So he did. By Jove, Jeeves, you're always right.
Meet me at the station with my things the first train after lunch. I'll go and lie low at the club for the rest of the morning.
Would you require my company on this visit, sir?
Do you want to come?
If I might suggest it, sir, I think it would be better if I remained here and kept in touch with Mr. Little. I might possibly hit upon some method of pacifying the various parties, sir.
Righto. But if you do, you're a marvel. I didn't enjoy myself much in Norfolk. It rained most of the time, and when it wasn't raining, I was so dashed jumpy I couldn't hit a thing. By the end of the week, I couldn't stand it any longer. Too bally absurd, I mean, being marooned miles away in the country just because young Bingo's uncle and wife wanted to have a few words with me. I made up my mind that I would pop back and do the strong, manly thing by lying low in my flat and telling Jeeves to inform everybody who called that I wasn't at home. I sent Jeeves a telegram saying I was coming and drove straight to Bingo's place when I reached town. I wanted to find out the general position of affairs, but apparently the man was out. I rang a couple of times, but nothing happened, and I was just going to leg it when I heard the sound of footsteps inside and the door opened. It wasn't one of the cheeriest moments of my career when I found myself peering into the globular face of Lord Biddlesham.
Oh, hello, I said,
and there was a bit of a pause. I don't quite know what I had been expecting the old boy to do if, by bad luck, we should ever meet again. But I had a sort of general idea that he would turn fairly purple and start almost immediately to let me have it in the gizzard. It struck me as somewhat rummy, therefore, when he simply smiled weakly. A sort of frozen smile it was. His eyes kind of bulged, and he swallowed once or twice. He said. I waited for him to continue, but apparently that was all there was.
Bingo in, I said, after a rather embarrassing pause.
He shook his head and smiled again. And then suddenly, just as the flow of conversation had begun to slacken once more, I'm dashed if he didn't make a sort of lumbering leap back into the flat and bang the door. I couldn't understand it.
but as it seemed that the interview, such as it was over, I thought I might as well be shifting. I had just started down the stairs when I met young Bingo charging up three steps at a time. "Hello, Bertie," he said. "Where did you spring from? I thought you were out of town." "I've just got back. I looked in on you to see how the land lay." "How do you mean?" "Why, all that business, you know." "Oh, that," said young Bingo airily. "That was all settled days ago. The dove of peace is flapping its wings all over the place. Everything's as right as it can be. Jeeves fixed it all up. He's a marvel, that man, Bertie. I've always said so. Put the whole thing straight in half a minute with one of those brilliant ideas of his." "This is topping. I knew you'd be pleased." "Congratulate you." "Thanks." "What did Jeeves do? I couldn't think of any solution of the bally thing myself." "Oh, he took the matter in hand and smoothed it all out in a second. My uncle and the little woman are tremendous pals now. They gas away by the hour together about literature and all that. He's always dropping in for a chat." This reminded me. "He's in there now," I said. "I say, Bingo, how is your uncle these days?" "Much as usual. How do you mean?" "I mean, he hasn't been feeling the strain of things a bit, has he? He seemed rather strange in his manner just now." "Why, have you met him?" "He opened the door when I rang, and then, after he stood goggling at me for a bit, he suddenly banged the door in my face. Puzzled me, you know. I mean, I could have understood it if he'd ticked me off and all that, but dash it, the man seemed absolutely scared." Young Bingo laughed a carefree laugh. "Oh, that's all right," he said. "I forgot to tell you about that. Meant to write, but kept putting it off. He thinks you're a loony." "He what?" "Yes, that was Jeeves's idea, you know. It solved the whole problem splendidly. He suggested that I should tell my uncle that I had acted in perfectly good faith in introducing you to him as Rosie M. Banks. That I had repeatedly had it from your own lips that you were, and that I didn't see any reason why you shouldn't be. The idea being that you were subject to hallucinations and generally potty. And then we got hold of Sir Roderick Glossop. You remember, the old boy whose kid you pushed into the lake that day down at Dittridge Hall? And he rallied round with his story of how he had come to lunch with you and found your bedroom full up with cats and fish, and how you had pinched his hat while you were driving past his car in a taxi, all that, you know. It just rounded the whole thing off nicely. I always say, and I always shall say, that you've only got to stand on Jeeves and fate can't touch you." "I can stand a good deal, but there are limits." "Well, of all the dashed bits of nerve I ever—" Bingo looked at me astonished. "You aren't annoyed," he said. "Annoyed? At having half London going about under the impression that I'm off my chump? Dash it all, Bertie," said Bingo, "you amaze and wound me. If I had dreamed that you would object to doing a trifling good turn to a fellow who's been a pal of yours for 15 years—" "Yes, but look here." "Have you forgotten," said young Bingo, "that we were at school together?" I pushed on to the old flat, seething like the dickens. One thing I was jolly certain of, and that was that this was where Jeeves and I parted company. A topping valet, of course, none better in London, but I wasn't going to allow that to weaken me. I buzzed into the flat like an east wind, and there was the box of cigarettes on the small table, and the illustrated weekly papers on the big table, and my slippers on the floor, and every dashed thing so badly right, if you know what I mean, that I started to calm down in the first 2 seconds. It was like one of those moments in a play where the chappie, about to steep himself in crime, suddenly hears the soft, appealing strains of the old melody he learned at his mother's knee. Softened, I mean to say. That's the word I want. I was softened. And then through the doorway there shimmered good old Jeeves in the wake of a tray full of the necessary ingredients, and there was something about the mere look of the man. However, I steeled the old heart and had a stab at it. "I have just met Mr. Little, Jeeves," I said.
"Indeed, sir."
He told me you had been helping him."
"I did my best, sir, and I am happy to say that matters now appear to be proceeding smoothly. Whiskey, sir?"
Thanks.
Jeeves?
Sir?
Another time.
Sir?
Oh, nothing. Not all the soda, Jeeves.
Very good, sir.
He started to drift out. Oh, Jeeves?
Sir?
I wish, that is, I think, I mean...
Oh, nothing.
Very good, sir. The cigarettes are at your elbow, sir. Dinner will be ready at 7:45 precisely, unless you desire to dine out.
No, I'll dine in.
Yes, sir.
Jeeves?
Sir?
Oh, nothing, I said.
Very good, sir,
said Jeeves.
End of Chapter 18. The End of The Inimitable Jeeves by P. G. Woodhouse.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.